Okay, any leftover questions from before? Okay, Marianne, do you want to come over to the microphone?
In forgiveness, I have trouble immediately doing that, and I just wonder if you would speak on time frames and how long or such a thing.
Okay, so Marianne is asking about forgiveness, and yes, it does have a timing. And remember that forgiveness is not something that we do, it's a grace that we receive. It's something that happens. You can't make yourself forgive. But what you can do, since forgiveness is related to some type of injury, you feel as if someone has hurt you, and then it seems hard to forgive that person. So, injury or hurt are experiences of loss. So the first thing they lead to, from the point of view of our own psychology, the way we're built, is grief. I'm sad. Three feelings. I'm sad that I was hurt. I'm angry at you for hurting me, and I'm afraid to speak up, or I'm afraid that things will never get any better. Some type of fear usually comes up. Or if you could apply it to a breakup, I'm sad that I'm alone, I'm angry at you for breaking up, and I'm afraid I'll never find somebody else. So it's always going to have those three elements. The pathway to the forgiveness has to be through the grief. Just the instant forgiveness, it doesn't seem like it's psychologically right. It seems like you're skipping a step. It's a kind of a bypass just to go directly to forgive. Remember, Christ said, Father, forgive them, but only after he went through all the grief of Holy Thursday and Good Friday. So, after this grief experience, you notice that you start to let go of blame and the need to hurt back, revenge. You notice this happening. Oh, I don't take it that seriously now. I'm in my own process, and I just notice that I'm not really holding it against the person. Blame is making the other person wrong. The other person is still accountable, but blame, which comes from the word for blaspheme, is more of a condemnation of someone. So you're no longer condemning, and you're no longer making the other person wrong, and you no longer need to hurt back. When you notice that happening in you, you have received the grace of letting go, and that is the grace of forgiveness. What is forgiveness? Letting go of blame and the need to hurt back. So this, of course, will take time because it has to go through this process, and it could take a day, a month, a year, many years, whatever it takes. We open ourselves to the grace, but we can't make it happen. So we keep our distance from the other until we get to this forgiving point, if we need to do it this way. And when you let go, the final step is you get on with your own life. No longer, this person no longer has power over your thoughts and feelings. You get on with your own life. What does get on with your own life mean other than journey, which is what we're here for? The journey was interrupted, and now the journey is continuing. So all graces make it possible to get back on the path. That's the purpose of grace, is to get us back on the path. What path? The path to being the kind of person who is continuing to evolve in love, in ways to show love, and in wisdom, ways to discern what's going on in my life and in the world in ways that are enlightened. Purpose of the journey? To grow in love, to evolve in wisdom. How can this happen? It happens because we let go of blame and retaliation. How did we get there? It was a grace, but we helped it along when we were willing to take responsibility for our own feelings of sadness, anger, and fear, rather than it was all your fault. Questions? Father? Yeah. Yes, I welcome your comments. Thank you.
I just think the Dalai Lama truly expresses that in his own life and witness, and in the light of political things that are surrounding him with the Chinese people and the Chinese government, yet he stands clearly on the side of compassion. And he has said, you know, when you're in darkness, you don't fight the darkness, you only increase the light. And even when his own people and monks are encouraging him to retaliate in violence, he stands his ground that the greatest lesson we have here is compassion, and learning compassion, even if it means the annihilation of our people, still the greatest good is compassion. Thank you for letting me.
Good. Okay, any other comments about it? So the timing will not be up to us, since it depends on grace. But once you do start to feel it, it gives you a sense of serenity. And the other person no longer has power over your thoughts and feelings. Okay, so let's go over to page 139. I just want to mention the three possible styles that we might find ourselves in. So let me give the origin of this first. Refugee and orphan children from World War II, who, babies especially, who were kind of warehoused in orphanages where there was not enough service for them. They were being fed and kept warm and changed, babies. But there was no time for the nurses to give them any affection or play with them. And an abnormal number of them were dying. This is called miasmas, lack of physical holding. And this psychoanalyst, John Bowlby, was hired by World Health Organization to figure this out. And he came up with this response, which I think helps us in other areas. He said, the babies go through three stages. In the first stage, they reach out to find the love that they really need. So they try to look fetching and they smile and they reach their arms out to be held. That's phase one. Because they know their need, they know what they need, and so they try to get it from other humans. Makes perfect sense. When that shows itself to be useless. In other words, when they notice they don't have it in them to get the love they need by reaching out, they go to phase two, which is protest with anger toward those who refuse. This is where they're shaking the crib, throwing the bottle out, stiffening up when they're being changed, and they're showing protest, anger. When this proves also useless, because the nurses are just forcing the bottle to them and making sure they get changed and so forth, when they notice this doesn't work, then many of them go into phase three, the final phase. This is the one where they start to die, called despair, which is, of course, the loss of hope. And on page 140, the despair stage has kicked in when there is no hope, no commitment, nothing left to be aroused or upset by, no interest in working things out, no belief in or energy for change. In other words, the journey has stopped. That would be despair. In such gloom, nothing that happens really matters anymore or has any impact. Everything has flatlined. And in relationships, this would show itself as fewer and shorter arguments. You tiptoe around each other, and you just no longer have much interest. So I apply this to relationships in general, since our topic is loving those that we know, and especially in working with clients in therapy. When a couple comes in, I always look for, where is each one of them at? Is he at stage one, two, or three? Is one or both still reaching out to try to work something out? Or are they just trying to get their licks in and hurt each other out of protest and anger? Or have one or both, it's rarely both, but sometimes one, is in despair. Doesn't have any belief that anything can be worked out. So we apply what happened to the babies to our own life, and we see that we too go through stages like this. With family members, with friends, and with partners. Are we still reaching out? Are we simply protesting with anger? Are we in despair that anything can be worked out? Obviously, we believe something can be worked out always. And so the despair is an illusion, but it's one that people can fall into. So the first stage has energy that you can use. The second stage still has energy, but it needs to be harnessed so that it will upgrade to phase one. But the third stage has no energy in it for change. So the energy is here in one and two, but in three it is vanished. This is an important feature of this whole question of love, because love as a commitment, as a practice, will have to be the kind of love that moves toward or is already in the reaching out stage. Reaching out, another way of putting it would be putting energy into. I'm still putting energy into getting this to be a go, as opposed to I have no energy left. I've often heard clients say, I'm done. I'm done would be despair of it working out. And of course, sometimes you are dumb, and then it's understandable. And you don't want to upgrade because you believe that it's over and you want to move on. That's certainly legitimate. It's just that we want to notice what these phases are and ask ourselves where we are in our own relationships. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask a question. When you've worked with couples who are in despair, do you find that in order to get them to reaching out, they have to go through the protest and anger part? And do you find that that's probably hard to allow that when it's probably also necessary?
She's asking a good question. Would the pathway from despair go back to the protest? Yes, because the protest is the same as the anger element of grief. So all couples who have problems that they're working on are somehow grieving because their expectations were not met. That's felt as a loss. So they're going to be angry at the one who did not meet the expectations. So if you want to move up, you would have to go through the anger. Of course, the real anger would be expressed as an ouch. This hurt, here's why, not I'm going to get back at you. That's not the real anger, that's the retaliation. Other questions about this?
Could you talk a little bit more? So you would be moving someone from despair into protest. And so you would be wanting to engender within them that anger?
Maybe a better way to put it would be, when you're in despair, can you make contact with your grief? And can you go to all three, your sadness, your anger, and your fear? That's what helps you recover energy that you can place into reaching out. I'm glad you brought that up. It isn't just anger. It will be the whole grief experience. A good example of grief, by the way, an important archetypal image of the real grief is the Pietà. This, the image of the Virgin Mary holding the dead body of Christ at the foot of the cross. She holds him just as he is, feeling her grief, but without retaliation. She has found a way to forgive the unforgivable. How does she do this? She simply holds the object of her love, that's her son. She simply holds him and lets herself feel the grief in his story and in hers, remembering that his story is different from hers, but at the same time, respecting it. Her calling was not to be crucified, but his was. And she's holding that without blame of anybody. Everybody see? I think this is why it's such an important image, and everybody responds to it with, even if you're not a Christian, something about that statue of Michelangelo is very, very moving to people. They know what's going on. She's just being with her grief. And she helps us when she sits like that, because she shows us, well, this is how you handle the unforgivable. Make sense to everybody? Question.
Yeah, I'm having some trouble with what this monk said about the Dalai Lama and the movement there, the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that what he's doing is putting his own people below the needs and wants of the Chinese. So, in other words, how do you address the fact that you have value and as much value as that person. So I don't get how that's a good.
Well, I think the idea that Larry was bringing up is that he has made a commitment. He's made a commitment to nonviolence, and so he. So when your commitment is to nonviolence, it means two things. We sometimes think of it as only one. It does not mean you sit back and let injustice happen without protest. So you continue to protest the injustice. You continue. You don't excuse it, but you do not use violent means. So you're still standing up for what you believe your truth is. You're just not going to the violent means to get there. So it would be kind of in that category. Does that fit with what you brought up, Larry?
Yes.
Yeah. Let Larry come back just for a minute, Ginny, and then you. Yeah.
I mean, I think his stand is disturbing even to some of his Tibetan people, even to his monks,
oh, yes.
Who say,
yeah.
Why doesn't he retaliate in violence? You know, violence is being done to us. Our people are being destroyed. Our culture is being destroyed. And yet, I think in his enlightened mind that the highest good is compassion. And that takes precedent over everything. So,
yes.
As his witness.
He has a special calling that would be hard for the rest of us to practice. He was given special graces to do what he does. So he gives us an example of the over-the-top way of loving, which we're going to talk about in a later class. Ginny?
I heard the Dalai Lama interviewed recently, and someone asked him that very question, and he said, well, we're not really free from blame here either. He said, we had restrained our gift to ourselves, and so we had not, even when people visited, we didn't open ourselves to them. We gave them only a certain amount. So he said there's always a light in the darkness. And what he saw was that when the Chinese invaded, yes, he felt the sadness for all the death. But when they invaded, it took it to the rest of the world. And it became, for all of humanity, became aware where as they held it into themselves, and held their love and their practice only for themselves, it kept it restrained.
Mm.
And that the real gift in all this that's happening is that now it's spread throughout the world.
Yes. And that's actually one of their prophecies. I read one of their ancient prophecies, and it said something like, I remember as kind of a humorous way of putting some things, but it said when people move along tracks, meaning trains, when something is invented so that people are able to move along tracks, but the person didn't know there was such a thing as a train. Something like if people move along tracks and our country is attacked, then Buddhism will come to the red-faced people. That's us. Now the people with our kind of complexion. Then Buddhism will come. The last part I know by heart. But then Buddhism will come to the red-faced people. So it's as if when the world improves and advances and we're attacked and we're still living in the past, that is what will get it to happen, that Buddhism will be spread, which is what has happened. One of the great gifts to humanity. Any other questions about this part? Back to... So it's good to ask yourself, where am I? Am I still putting energy into how can I show all the love that I have? Or am I angry about something and holding it back? Or have I just given up and saying, oh, that doesn't really work anyway? And by the way, this kind of love that we're talking about, which has compassion, which is not based on reciprocity and which does not retaliate, this kind of love we're talking about, is not a strategy. You can do this for your whole life and it won't necessarily work for you. You would do this because this is who you are. You wouldn't do this because, oh, people will like me more if I do this. It isn't like that. Well, most likely you will be liked more, but you don't have that as your purpose. Okay. So, I want to go on to this important question, why do we hurt the people we love? Now I'm on page 156 of How to Be an Adult in Love. And I'd like to point certain ones of these out. What do we mean by hurt those we love? We hurt them when we judge them for their behavior, when we try to control them, when we don't take their needs seriously or their boundaries seriously. We keep crossing their boundaries, interfering with their life. When we insist that they have to do things our way. But we certainly have noticed that we seem to hurt the people we love more than the people we don't know at all. So this is an important question. Why would we do this? And I have made an attempt to come up with 10 different possible answers. The first one is that it seems to go with the territory, because part of any relationship is expectations. And when these expectations are disappointed, you will feel hurt. And that hurt is part of the pain of being in a relationship. So this first hurt that I'm referring to does not happen. Let's just say natural hurt that goes with all comings and goings and all disappointments. This is not the malicious hurt that would appear in the protest phase. It's not malicious intention to hurt. It just happens naturally by being in a relationship. If you're going to be in a relationship, you will feel some hurt because people will at times disappoint you. And I have here, middle of that paragraph in number one, the stronger the bond, the harder we are hit by what happens between us. Secondly, when the other person's in pain, we will feel pain also. So it hurts to be in a relationship. It hurts because you're taking it seriously. And it's okay to take it seriously, and it's okay to experience these natural hurts. They just go with the territory. Follow everybody? It's good. If you're going to learn how to ice skate, then you are going to fall sometimes, and it'll feel painful, but that's all part of it. Secondly, when you love someone, you spend a lot of time with them. Sometimes you even live together, and so you kind of get too close for comfort, shall we say. You start scraping up against each other. That hurts also. That one also is natural. Now, the next one is not natural. Here's where we try to make someone over. Try to make somebody into what you want them to be. Because you're needy, and you, as I say here, there's still too much neediness in our way of loving. The other person knows we love him in our own somewhat dysfunctional way and is trying to please us, yet he still wants to be himself, so he contests our attempts to control him. But this brings pain into the relationship. On the next page, we usually exercise vigilance over what we say to acquaintances and people we meet on the street, people we meet in a store, let's say, kind of on our best behavior. But we're so comfortable with the people we love that we just say anything. We don't exercise vigilance. So that hurts. We might have leftover anger from childhood. Most of us have tried to clear out some of the issues from childhood, but if one of your parents hurt you, you were unable to get back at the parent who hurt you, you might be hurting your spouse or friend to get back at the original abuser. Everybody follow how that works? So for that, you'd have to grieve the past and let go of it. The only guarantee that you will not repeat it in an adult relationship. It's top of 159. We may still be enraged at how our parents disappointed us, even if there was no abuse. Our survival may have been at stake if we spoke up in childhood, but in a relationship of trust, we are not in that danger, so we displace our original anger onto our partner. We may be trying to get back at our parents by our hurtful actions toward the person we love now. Our anger was never resolved, so it festers inside and lashes out at the one on whom it's safe to inflict it. We're like that. So we would have to notice that and admit it. And some of us carry a history of being hurt and abused, and so we act toward others the way the original abusers acted toward us. Last time we talked about the shadow side, which is the dark side that emerges, and that can rear its ugly head in a relationship, expressed as, sometimes we notice that our worst side comes up when we're in a relationship. And I think what's happening is your psyche is trying to work something out. It's trying to work something out, but it's doing it in all the wrong ways. Because it's implicating someone else in your work. We may be angry that she does not love us with the same intensity that we show toward her. No matter how close we are to someone, moments of anger arise. And when that anger is not expressed and resolved, it can come out in passive ways. So we hurt the one we love without having to admit to ourselves that there's so much aggression in us. You'd have to say to your partner, well, can you love me, shadow and all? because it's not a very appealing style. And the final one that I want to mention, which I didn't go into in detail in the book, is, not yet anyway, is ego, when it is inflated so that you become self-centered, then you don't notice the needs of the other person. Because you're so focused on your own needs. And secondly, and making it even worse, you feel that you're entitled to have the other person focus on your needs the same way you focus on them. So that's certainly going to lead to experiences of pain in the relationship. Any questions about this? All we know is that betrayal can happen when there's no reason for it. It's as if trust hired the assassin of love to attack and destroy itself. Enigmatic and poignant indeed are the tears in our human story. So you get in a relationship with someone who you think will be relationship-centered, then you find out that his ego is so big that he can't really see you or be with you in a loving way. That will be felt as a terrible betrayal. But by now, he's already hooked you. So you can't let go because he has seduced you into this close relationship, and you can't leave because you feel those strong feelings, but yet you're basically dealing with a childlike, childish, self-centered, narcissistic ego that believes itself entitled to get love but not to have to give it. Yet we can't seem to release ourselves because we're so hooked. Everybody follow? And I give the poem by William Blake to refer to that. He himself said that this poem was referring to intimate love, especially sexual. Oh, Rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night, in the howling storm, has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. So the gardener is looking at the rose, and it's very beautiful, but when he looks carefully, he sees the aphids. And he realizes, oh, you let something in that's actually killing you. But you let it in because it looked appealing. So he's pointing out an experience in which love, it seems like love, and it feels that way. But eventually you find out that it's actually hurting you. Another, shall we say, poignant dimension of how we relate to each other. Okay, our time is about up, but any final questions on this? I hope I'm not leaving you on a very sad note. I'll try to say something pleasant before we end. Okay, one last question.
Thank you. I just like about that poem. Who's the author, please, of the poem?
William Blake. It's in your book on page. It's on page.
Oh, the next page. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
William Blake. Thank you so much.
Yeah, 160.
I love
the poetry. Oh, okay. Well, thank you. Good. Well, I just think we have a lot to be proud of because we're willing to look at all these issues and pay attention to them, and we're really noticing that the human story is deeply in us, and there are always ways to work with it so that the result is our moving along on our path. And even when we look at the hard dimensions of all this, we kind of make peace with these features of ourselves and of others and just say, oh, okay, it was like that, so now I need to go to whatever my next step is. So, go in peace to love and serve the world. Thank you.